There's two things I like about startups. I mean, startups is just a vehicle to create a team. And I love teams. I love organizing teams. I come from a big family. I have three brothers and three sisters. And I played in a lot of bands. I played a lot of sports. And I just love the dynamics of a team. And a startup is just a vehicle in which you can create a team. So I love that. If companies didn't exist, I would find some other way to get people together.
Hello, hello, Tamara here, your host, another episode of Inside Lawn Street Podcast. Super excited you're here. This is the place to be. If you are looking to unlock the power of innovation in your work and life, if you are looking to perform at that higher level, to tap your greatest competitive advantage, that innovative mind between your two ears, so incredible. And I think today's podcast guest is going to help us do that. My guest today is Paul English. He's the founder of Kayak, the travel site that pretty much all of us have used. So yeah, he knows a thing or two about how to build a business, about innovation, about taking on the giants in the industry, about the element of design inside your business and your product, innovation across the business. It's an incredible episode. I'm looking forward to it. He's also the founder of Moonbeam, which is new to come out, which is a whole new way to think about podcasts. I'll put the link to all of it in the show notes, but we got a lot to cover. So, hey, before we do that, I want to tell you about one of my favorite all-time resources over here at Inside Lawn Street. And this resource gives me the ability to make personal connections over email. I know, so hard to do, and everybody's emails are so full. But with this resource, I get to send video emails where people can see my face in the video, in the email, of course, in the video. And that resource is called BombBomb, B-O-M-B, B-O-M-B. It allows me, it's just one click, I click record, it gets embedded into my email, and I send. It has allowed me to create human connections over email. And guess what? When I send BombBomb videos, my emails get returned. When I don't, they sometimes do, but it takes a little bit longer. But I'm telling you, the return rate with BombBomb is way higher. All right, go get some BombBomb. I'll put the link in the show notes. For now, let's get to this incredible interview. Hey, everybody. Tamara here at Inside Lawn Street for yet another amazing interview. So let me just share why I wanted to have Paul, who's going to introduce himself in a minute, our guest on today. As you all know, one of my biggest pet peeves is people that talk a game but haven't actually done things. I mean, there's a lot of people out there who are great orators, but they're not great doers. I like to talk to people who are doers because that's where we get the real insights and the real meat around how to do things, how to go further faster. And I think just more importantly, those lessons around work and life that come along the way that I think you can't write about unless you've actually experienced. So Paul, super excited to have you today on the show. Welcome. And hey, why don't you introduce yourself for those who don't know you? And then I'm excited to dig in.
All right, Tamara, thanks very much. I'm delighted to be on the show. So I'm a serial entrepreneur. I've started 6 or 7 tech companies and 3 nonprofits. And the nonprofits are ones that are doing well and scaling, and I'm still very active in running those. So I spend a lot of my time on my nonprofit work. Of the companies I've started, I'm best known for Kayak, which I co-founded in 2004. We took it public 2012 and then sold it 2013 to Priceline. My day job is running a business travel and spend management company called Lola.com, which is pretty exciting. We started doing business travel, and then we, with the pandemic and no one traveling last year, we were selling very successfully travel management into CFOs. And then we started selling other things into CFOs to help them manage not just how their employees spend money on travel, but how they spend money on everything. Things they buy at Amazon, things they order that gets paid by invoice. So we really help people with any employee spend, including travel or anything else. And then I think the way, Tamara, you and I got introduced is that you were interested in one of my side projects that's really been heating up called Moonbeam. And that's a new podcast player coming out next month.
So, okay. So I have so many questions for you, but I want to start with something personal and then I want to dig into the business side.
because you've done so much. What's one thing we'd be surprised to learn about you?
Mm-hmm. One of my hobbies is playing a game called Xiangqi. It's a Chinese version of chess.
Oh.
It's 2,000 years old. Some people call it the most popular board game in the world, with over 500 million people who play. And I learned it in grad school from a couple of Vietnamese students, actually. This game is very popular in Vietnam, and I just became obsessed with it. So I actually have a website, xiangqi.com. It's xiangqi.com, where we can teach people how to play the game, and they can meet people around the world to chat with and play the game with.
So you just answered my question, because I was going to ask you where I find out about it. So I learned chess from my kids. I have two boys. They're 16 and 12 now, but they've been in the chess club since they were in elementary school. So that's how I learned to play chess. But it's funny, it's one of the things that I never grew up with, and then I got obsessed about. So I feel like this is something my family should know about. So thank you for sharing.
Yeah, and if your kids are playing chess, I'd definitely introduce them to this game. Yeah. We have a really cool, just like a 2-minute YouTube video aimed at chess players to say, if you know chess, here's the things like different it. About Xiangqi. But if you go to Xiangqi.com, which you can also get to through ChineseChess.com, it's the same site. If you click around the help pages, you'll see our YouTube video, which shows the difference. Yeah, it's a pretty fun game.
Yeah, it's cool. And I think it's really exciting, actually, whatever that is for whomever, when you find something that clicks with you and you get really, I don't know if obsessed is the right word, maybe passionate about it, and it kind of creates a life of its own in your own life. I think that's really cool. So I want to ask you about your life and your work. So one of the things that I was intrigued by is, you know, you've started a lot of businesses. You mentioned Kayak being the one I think we know the most, the travel website. How do you determine a good opportunity? Because you've had some good successes. So I think part of the challenge for a lot of us, and I would put myself in that sometimes, is seeing if something is really a need of the market, or if it's something that I just personally go, oh, I want that. So how do you determine that? What's your criteria?
It's a little bit different with each company. And there's really two questions there that you just asked. One of them is, where does the idea come from? And the second one is, how do I know whether it's an idea worth pursuing? So if I could answer both of those questions, in terms of how did they come from, it's either a pain that I'm experiencing myself, something that's very frustrating. So for example, Moonbeam, the podcast player, was generated out of my use of the Apple Podcast app, which I think is terrible.
Horrible.
And in using that so much, I just said podcasts are really important to me. It's an important way to open our minds and get new information. And why are we stuck with this really terrible app? And so I want to do some better than that. Sometimes the idea will come from a friend. When I created my e-commerce company, Boston Light, which I sold to Intuit and then served as VP technology there for 4 years, that was created because one of my friends, Bob Treitman, was running a bookstore. This is back in the late 90s. And he was afraid of Amazon going to put him out of business. And so we basically said, what if we made it really easy for anyone to set up an Amazon-like store on their own domain name? And that began the development of a product. So that was, my friend had a pain point. Now, the second question you asked, I think, is once you have an idea, how do you know if it's worth pursuing? Like, how do I vet that? And the easiest way I describe how to know whether your idea is worth pursuing, because startups, they're really hard work. Like, you're on 24/7, and I mean nights and weekends, and you're doing email with your co-founders all the time. There's many months and quarters where you think you're going to miss payroll. Sometimes you have to lay people off if the revenue doesn't come in fast enough. There's a lot of painful things about it, and most startups fail. Now, if someone wants to go down this path, but they want to make sure, how am I making the right decision? Should I get on this path? Is this just like this scary ton of work we're going to work really hard for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years or more and end up with nothing and working really hard? Like, how do I know? My litmus test is simply try to find an amazing co-founder, someone that you would feel you'd be incredibly lucky to work with and that you trust completely, and someone who you think on their own could be very successful building a company. And then see if you can convince them to work on the idea with you for free. If you can get them to work with you, the two of you working for free on developing the idea, and you're working as equal partners, that's the first test that indicates that you're onto something here. You're compelling enough to convince someone to do this, and the story is compelling enough.
So that's interesting, because I think that's got to be work for free is the key there, right? Because people will do a lot of things for money, but to get someone so passionate to work for free, that's a whole different ballgame. I want to go back and ask you though, because you had started to say, you know, a lot of startups fail, 100% true. And you had said a couple things kind of about why they failed, just kind of in passing, but I'd love to dig in a little bit there. Why do you think they fail? And how do you avoid some of those traps, if they're even avoidable? How did you guys think, those hurdles?
Yeah, I think there's two reasons that startups fail. One is there's a founder implosion. The co-founders end up hating each other and they create a toxic work environment and people just leave because work should not be hard, but like work should be fun. And if the startup founders are fighting and creating, again, a toxic environment, no one wants to work there. And that ends up breaking companies apart. And then the second thing is, like, let's say I work in tech. So in tech, it's not that they fail because their code didn't work. I mean, maybe like really exotic tech, like build a spaceship or something. In most cases, like software tools and languages are pretty advanced right now and testing methodology that for the most part, if you hire decent engineers, you can get the product to work. But the way it fails is they build a decent enough product for a problem that no one cares about. In other words, the founder might care about a problem, say, this is a big problem, let's build a solution to it. But that founder, he or she hasn't vetted that problem enough with enough customers to know, is this like a nice to have? Or would this potential customer say, oh my God, I would do anything to have a solution like that.
So then how did you figure that out? Because I think, I'm a big believer in people need to, I need to see if people would open up their wallets and pay me, even if it's just a dollar for this product, for me to know. So I have a real frustration with focus groups and things that are in theory, do they like this product? I've spent 25 years in new product development, and I cannot tell you the number of times I walked out of a focus group where the customers in the room or potential customers said, yeah, I would totally, here's some things I would improve, but I totally love it, I would buy it. And in my head, I'm thinking, you know what? I don't think they would. And sure enough, you know, when some of those products launched later on, they didn't work. So, because I think there's just a huge disconnect there. I think you have to battle test in real life and see if people open up their wallets. How have you found is the best way, particularly at the beginning where you don't have the product, to vet the idea for that in particular? Because I think that's what you just said there, I just want from Launch Street. I think that's the one of the biggest challenges that people without any innovator, without any kind of idea faces is this just something I care about, or is this something a big enough market cares about that they would pay and they would pay for it?
Yeah, entrepreneurs need to beware false positives. Yeah. Focus groups are one way to get false positives because you're paying people to sit in some ugly hotel room, conference room, with terrible food behind a one-way mirror. They think because you're paying them to do this, they have to be nice to you. Yeah. And some of them are critical, and this group think that happens in focus groups. You have to be skilled to know how to manage that. But I think that focus groups are a little bit biased towards they want to say something nice about you because you're paying them. Same thing when entrepreneurs go to raise money. One thing that I coach young entrepreneurs is 100% of the VC meetings, you're going to walk out, they're thinking like, oh my God, they love me. And the thing is, VCs, if they haven't made up their mind yet, they want optionality to do more due diligence or just to put you on hold. And then if things get hot and some of the top VCs come in, they want to jump in. Like people complain that VCs are like lemmings. And when one goes, then they all go. You have to, as an entrepreneur, beware of the false positive.
Yeah.
And like with focus groups, for example, I do use focus groups and you have to run them a certain way and you have to use them efficiently. One of the things I do is, this sounds crazy, but I give my email address out to all the focus group attendees. I say, okay, I'm the founder of the company. My email is paul@lola.com, for example, which is my Lola email. So if anyone wants travel or spend management, please feel free to email me and I'll reply. But I'll give out my email and I'll see if any of them email me. And it's one thing in the focus group to say, oh yeah, that looks like really nice. But are they actually going to follow up with me? And then if I ask them a question, are they going to answer my question? So you want to look at, do your customers just say, that was nice? Or do they take initiative? Do they want to keep engaging with you? It's the same thing when I said, looking for a co-founder. Are they proactive? Are they going to want to work with you for free? Is it you emailing them all the time, or are they also emailing you? You have to look at that ratio.
So I love that, just calling it a false positive. I think that's a really important for all of us to think about. And who we ask, I think, matters too. You know, you ask your family and friends and they don't want to squelch your dreams. So they're going to love it, right? We got to ask people. One of the things I did years ago, which is one of my favorite, probably one of the most exhausting days of my life, because I was standing in a mall for 16 hours, but is we set up a little kiosk with false products just to see if people would even come over and talk to us. We really didn't have anything to sell, but we wanted to see, like, will people talk to us? Do they have questions? Do they walk on by? It was one of the most, I think, inexpensive, exhausting, and fascinating days to test a product idea that we had. And it turned out we had some problems and we needed to fix it. So I'm
That's glad. Amazing.
That, yeah, I know it was, I'm a huge fan of doing stuff like that. So I want to go back to a couple things you said. And so the first one is, you know, you had said the Apple Player sucks. And here's why I want to dig into that. It's not because I want to sit here and trash Apple Player, although as a podcast host, I couldn't agree more. And I can't figure out how to search for podcasts that I like, or I don't even know why sometimes they download and sometimes they don't. Like it's a really frustrating player. But the reason I want to dig into it with you and with Moonbeam is I think oftentimes there are areas out there that we just deal with the frustration and we don't see the opportunity in them. So we just go, oh, well, it's Apple and it's a big player and like it is what it is. And then there's so much room for innovation and for an idea there, for a viable one, but we just take it for granted. And I guess I'm not even sure my question is here, Paul, but I just want to throw that out to you, because to me, that's one of the areas where we all just accept it to be a problem. And then here you are actually trying to do something about it. But so many of us miss that because we just accept the frustration, whatever that is.
Yeah. Okay. So I have three quick things to say about that.
Yeah.
When we started Kayak, people said, how could you possibly compete against Expedia? They spend $1 billion a year in advertising. There's no way some little startup with $7 million in the bank can ever get known against them. But it just motivated us to say, we have a different view about the travel market. We have a different view about user interface and what looks like good product, what doesn't look like good product. And we just innovated really rapidly. And the first version of Kayak was probably terrible, but we kept innovating and innovating and innovating. And we moved at a speed faster than a big company can run at. And eventually we figured out. So I think part of it is just sort of diligence and doing the work. Second thing, let me see. I had three, your question prompted three things. It was just like, do the work. The other thing is, ideas are worth nothing. People come to me with ideas all the time. And I'll say, that's interesting. If you don't have the skills to run the company your own, maybe I can try to find you a co-founder. And they'll say, well, I want 90% of the company. I said, if you're not going to run the company, how can you get 90%? And people think their ideas are worth a lot. They're not. There's a million ideas. You can go on Reddit all day long and look at product ideas. What matters is execution, not the idea. I mean, a good idea is important, but what's more important is the execution. And then the last point that your question reminded me of, the whole idea of where did new ideas come from? I think the first thing you have to do is tune yourself to be a problem detector. So when you're using Apple Podcast Player, and I'm sorry to dump on them today, but when you're using it and you notice it doesn't work right, you notice little things like why the podcast listed in the wrong order episodes, you know? When you notice things wrong about it, take note of it, like write it down, email it to someone, create a Google document as an exercise about things I don't like about Instagram or whatever. And have that, develop that critical eye, develop that muscle about how can I improve something?
So I like that idea of writing down like the things I don't like. I mean, it sounds so negative, but really what you're saying, Paul, which I think for Inside Launch Street, this is a great exercise for all of us to do for the rest of the week. I think that's a great way, to your point, to improve your critical thinking skills and to find opportunities where you didn't before. Because I do think all too often we just let it go. I interviewed a while back, Mike Dubin is the founder of Dollar Shave Club. And he was talking about really, he just was listening to all these conversations he and his friends were having about how frustrating it was to buy a simple razor and how it'd become like super complicated and, you know, 10 blades and a pivot head and blah, blah, blah for something that should be so basic. But he followed that frustration and did something about it, which I think, you know, exactly what you're saying. What does Moonbeam do? Let's start there. And then I got a few questions off of that.
Yeah. So Moonbeam is a brand new podcast player. The website is moonbeam.fm, where people can sign up to get on the wait list. The product is not released yet, but we're expecting it's going to come out at the end of May. And Moonbeam looks at two things. One, the whole discovery process about, you know, there's 2 million podcasts out there. How do people find your show?
Yeah.
So we're focused on discovery, and we think we have a unique angle there, which I can describe in a minute. And the second thing we focus on is, what's the relationship between the podcast host and her listeners? Like, is there a relationship? They listen to your podcast. Do you know as a host what parts they like, what part they didn't like? Do you know when they laughed? What during your show made them laugh? Do you know at what point in your show they turned it off because they got bored or they didn't like one of your guests? We're trying to give an interaction between the host and the audience. We want, if someone's really inspired by your show, we want them to click one button and join your email list. So now they can get a newsletter from you. If they're inspired by one of your guests or by something you say in the show, we want them to click a button and send a dollar to your show or $10 to support the creator or to a nonprofit that you like. If you talk about products on one particular episode, let's say you have a guest who just has a new book that comes out and you're talking about his or her book, why can't some of the podcasts just click one button and have the book show up at the house the next day? So it's all about the tools that engage. You know, why can't they have a like threaded discussion group right in the app? So you see what people are responding to in real time at different points in the podcast episode, right, what they're thinking about that episode. So at a high level, Moonbeam does two things. We focus on discovery and we focus on interaction between the listeners and the hosts.
So I love that because I think it's been really interesting. I think podcasts is such an amazing opportunity for people to share insights and interviews like these and like get to know new people and learn new things. Yet it is so hard to figure out, unless it's word of mouth right now, where to even find those. And I'm curious about the engagement side because I think really you're solving, I mean, you already know this, but you're solving two problems. One is for the podcast host who has no data and says, I don't even know if they're listening all the way through. Do they like it? You know, did this part really speak to them? Did it not? But also for the listener, because I think, you know, people want to be engaged, right? Nobody wants a one-way conversation anymore. And they have to expect that, which is, I think, where podcast is a little bit challenging because here we are having a one-way conversation. I mean, not you and I, but like to the listeners. And what's interesting too, is I think Clubhouse has really threatened that with their new app because now like anyone can have panel discussions. So it's interesting to me. So here's my question about Moonbeam. And I think this applies to Kayak and sounds like some of the other stuff you've done too. I think oftentimes with an innovative business like yours that even when it's solving a major pain point or kind of opening up a new market, it still has a learning curve. So it's a new behavior, a new way of doing something, a new way to, for both, I think the product and the market, excuse me, to engage. And that learning curve I have found can really make or break an organization, a company, a startup, right? Because either people get it on board fast enough, right? So they can get some revenues in and keep going or not, or it's just a little bit too far out there or the startup didn't do the job to get the customers to understand how to use it. How do you see the learning curve and how have you figured out how to overcome it or at least shorten it?
The learning curve The learning curve for like a new application, you mean, for a new product, like for Moonbeam?
Well, yeah, let me give you an example of what I mean. And then, so for example, well, let's take Kayak. You know, when Expedia and then Kayak and like when that whole thing started, our behavior as consumers, customers, was to go to the different websites, look at the different prices, open up the different tabs, right? And then kind of bounce around from place to place. And then this comes out and we're able to go to one place and look for everything, but we're used to doing it a different way. So there's a behavior change that has to happen. And while even when it benefits us, sometimes we are, as humans, we struggle with change. So we don't always get on board as fast. How do you help people engage in a new product, whether that's technology-based or not, when there's actually a behavior change involved in it as well? Does that make sense? Hopefully I'm not talking in circles, but I think
I think I get it. So I can give a couple examples. So I guess my base rule is you need to deliver value instantly. So the first time someone touches your product, they're going to have an intent, which is someone told them about your website. So when they come to your website or to use your product or buy your product, they're going to have an expectation about it, the expectation that caused them to go to buy your product or go to your website in the first place.
Yeah.
Then what you need to do, you need to understand that intent. And the intent sometimes is different than what you thought it was, because you might market one way, but your early users might view you differently and might spread word of mouth that you're a little bit different than the way you're initially marketed. So understand that intent and deliver value instantly. So at Kayak, we were obsessed with speed of results. Typically, state of the art when Kayak was released was Expedia flight search speed took almost a minute, and we wanted ours to be like 4 seconds, which we got to, but it took us years because it's non-trivial because you're sitting on a lot of old technology at the airlines, and I can describe in detail how we did that. But we wanted to deliver results really, really quickly in a display that people haven't seen before, particularly with a lot of white space and just a clean layout. When I used to look at Expedia, I thought it was like epileptic seizure inducing. There was so much going on the website, so many animations and ads. It was like hard to see what I wanted to see because there was so much stuff going on there. With Kayak, we wanted the opposite of that. So your friend tells you about Kayak. You go to the website, you say, I want to go to San Francisco. Bam, we paint the screen immediately, which is the best results. On the left side, we let you filter that. So what if I leave at 6 p.m.? What if I leave at 7 p.m.? And the page updates instantly, which didn't happen at Expedia. And then when you see that flight, we're going to show you, you can buy it at American Airlines for $200. You can buy it at Orbitz for $204. Like, we show you every place you can buy it. So we wanted to do something that was shockingly different than you didn't experience before. We're successful if we deliver that instant recognition that this is different and unique. And that's what will get people to come back and tell their friends. Another example, so TikTok is an app that we all like talking about because that has taken the world by storm. I think it has probably 1 billion users right now. The thing about TikTok is they have to deliver interesting content to you immediately. Yeah. And then the more, and what they've realized is they're pretty smart about this. Not everyone has the same taste. So something I might, you know, some comedian I might follow on TikTok, you think it's totally bizarre and you don't like that comedian, but simply this gesture of swiping up, like if you see something, you instantly have no interest, just swipe up, and it watches, which videos do you watch? How many seconds do you spend on it? Do you share it with a friend? Do you save it? Do you double tap it to star it? And they watch these interactions, and their machine learning system then over time starts delivering videos to you that are really compelling to you and that are very different than videos I might see on TikTok. Like, TikTok has figured out, who knew? Like, I really love dogs. I see tons of dog videos. I don't actually own a dog. My kids own dogs. But TikTok has shown me some hilarious and, you know, funny videos about that. But the thing that, you know, that Kayak did and that TikTok did is to deliver value instantly, as quickly as possible.
So here's my question on that, because I think this is something a lot of people struggle with. Well, I know because people have asked me about it. So I think there's a difference between doing it better and doing it different. And I think kind of different beats better at any day of the week. So like if you have a service or let's just use products, easier example. And you know, let's go back to the razors for a minute, because now that's stuck in my head. But you know, you have a razor with one blade, then the next company comes out with a razor with two blades, and then it's three blades. And so like, it just is this never ending hamster wheel of better. How do you figure out, how have you in the past and with Moonbeam too figured out how to differentiate it relative to the competition so that it matters?
I think the first thing is there's a thing that I call founder integrity, which is you have to have a point of view about how you as the founder look at the world, how you look at products. And like at Kayak, we were obsessed with speed and simplicity. I've never seen anyone do a VC pitch that says, we're going to compete with this product, except we're going to be faster and cleaner. Like, most people don't get that. But for us, it was in our DNA. And what we became known for was speed and simplicity, because it's just literally the way we think. As far as differentiation, so there's some founder integrity about how you think and do you think different? And then there's just test different messages. along the way. Digital marketing, like on AdWords, lets you do things like put up an ad for a product you don't have. And it lets you try different language to see which language gets clicked on. And that can help guide you. I mean, it's almost like clickbait. It can guide you to which languages, which concepts are ones that seem appealing to people enough that they're going to click into it. That's not a perfect measure, but it is one that I've used at several companies. So I guess I would start from integrity of how the founders actually think. Do they view the world differently? And then once you build your solution, to describe it, try to describe it in a lot of different ways until you find the one that clicks.
You had talked a minute ago, we were talking about technology and, you know, Moonbeam, I think you have said, let me make sure I get it right. You had said it's a combination of machine learning and human curation. I think technology is able to do so much these days. I'm just curious how you see the intersection between kind of technology and the human side of it and how that plays into Moonbeam.
Well, very few of us install apps just to have more tech on our phones. I think most people would say there's too much tech on our phones. Like another thing is I had a TV installed in my apartment and the guy who installed it left me with a universal remote. This thing has more buttons on it than like the space shuttle. I'm looking at this thing saying, do you think anyone thought maybe we should put even more buttons on a remote? Like, I don't want more tech. I want less tech. I actually like the Apple remote, the Apple TV remote, because there's so few buttons on. It's like, turn the volume up and down, menu, confirm. Like, it's very, very simple. So I think in terms of usability versus tech, I would say the first thing to designers and engineers is try to be a minimalist and try to cut down your tech to make it so simple that you want your competitors making fun of you. I remember at Kayak, we used an underlying technology called ITA software. They built a lot of software for airlines and we used them to do our flight search. And for years, I was friends with the founder of ITA, Jeremy Wertheim, a really extremely brilliant engineer. And for years, we had this friendly thing between the two companies where the engineers at ITA said, Kayak is a joke. It's just this thin UI layer on top of ITA. Kayak has no technology. And whenever I heard that, it made me smile because they were proving my point. Right. I don't want to be known as a tech company. I want to be known as a company. Ask me a question, I show the answer. And I don't show you all the stuff that's going on behind the scenes. I try to make it as simple as I possibly can. So I guess I would say on usability, just try really hard. Like, do you really need that extra button on that screen? What would it look like if it wasn't there? Like, just try to reduce as much as you can and make things as simple as you can.
I think that's great advice across a lot of ideas. I find that we as the creator of the ideas overcomplicate things. And I'm guilty of this too. I mean, we get so wrapped up in the details of it. And then we think everything's important and everything has to be shared. And whether that's messaging or the technology itself. But I think you're right. I think, and I love Kayak. I use it all the time. But I think the reality, and I expect to use Moonbeam because you're solving the two problems that I have. One is I want people to be engaged. I would love more. I love talking to you, but I would love engagement too. Yeah. I want to connect to my listeners and I feel so removed from them otherwise. And it's the one place in my business where I feel removed from people. It's kind of funny, right? Because you have all these thousands of listeners and yet I don't have any interaction with them. And that just to me doesn't make sense at all, actually. But I think there's so much value in simplicity. So for those listening and watching, I just want to remind you of that, whether that is a meeting presentation that you have with your boss or because you're presenting a report or, you know, you're launching a product, whether that's tech or service based, I think simplicity is key. And we as founders of the ideas just, I think we get lost in our own heads.
Yeah, it's important. Like, you don't want to ask your customers to design your product. I never put a survey on my site saying, which feature should I build next? Because customers aren't product managers and they often don't know what's possible. So they might not come up with the ideas. However, I do work really close with my customer to see what part of the product they use versus not use. I'm very data driven. So if something on my page is not clicked a certain percent of the time, we delete it. So we really look at what people use and what they don't use and how often they use different parts of the site. There's also this thing where I say that most engineers do not have the intellectual stamina to perfect something. Mm-hmm. If you're building a tech company, you need to find those engineers that do, and don't make them perfect the entire product, but make them perfect the part of the product that people use the most.
Mm. You know, it's funny. One of the things well, at least it's been my experience anyway, is that my programmers, coders, engineers, like all those people are amazing at the product, but I got to really make sure I push the usability and the simplicity side. It's not because they're not brilliant. They're absolutely brilliant at what they do, but they have a skill over here and I have the skill over here and I'm connected to the outside world more than they are. And it's the blend of the two that really makes it work. And, you know, it's interesting. You just reminded me of a while back, I was doing these user groups. It was a healthcare company doing a back-end revenue stream software, basically, or revenue coding stuff. And I'll never forget, we did the first user groups with potential customers. So basically we had them a Zoom like this, we shared the screen, they took control and we saw where they moved their mouse. And all 90% of what we thought was important that was on that screen, they could have cared less about. Like maybe they wanted to dig into later, but they really could have cared less. So I think couldn't have cared less. Your advice about simplicity here is key. I wanna bring it back to you before we have to close out, Paul. In the very beginning of this interview, you had said like, this is a 24, being an entrepreneur, starting an idea of any kind is kind of 24/7. What you've done a lot of it and you've done it really successfully. So what keeps you coming back if it's so hard?
There's two things I like about startups. I mean, startups is just a vehicle to create a team. And I love teams. I love organizing teams. I come from a big family. I have three brothers and three sisters. And I played in a lot of bands. I played a lot of sports. And I just love the dynamics of a team, and a startup is just a vehicle in which you can create a team. So I love that. If companies didn't exist, I would find some other way to get people together. The second thing is I love design. I love software design. I love that you can go from a drawing and a piece of paper to a product which makes money. It's like very, very cool. And not even the money, because the money is secondary to me, but to a product that people love. Just go from a concept to a product people love. I would, like, if there was no such thing as the internet or no jobs where I couldn't get paid as an engineer or designer, I would pay to do design work on the weekends. If I had to work, I don't know, as a therapist or something during the week, on the weekend, I would join a guild that I would pay that would let me program. It's like, that's how much fun I have. And these days, more design than development.
Yeah. So I'm only smiling because I think you do have to love whatever it is you're doing that much to be in for the highs and lows. How do you deal with the highs and the lows? Because there's both. It's not everyone, we all want to believe it's a straight line up, even when we have a winner, but it's not. So what advice do you have for the rest of us for getting through what's really a roller coaster?
I think the most important thing is to have a co-founder that's equally vested in the company. I like 50-50 partners. And so when you're having a bad day, they have to lift you up and vice versa. And then you want to fill your team with optimists, people that say, we will find a way, we will find a way. I mean, there's a role for having some realists on your team, but in general for startup, I bias towards optimists, for people to say, okay, that's a problem. There's an opportunity here.
Yeah. I always like to, I always have this little thing in my hiring checklist about, are they an opportunist? Because I want them to be the type of person that always wants to figure out how to solve the problem and believe that there's a way, I think, to your point. Because if they don't believe it, it's not going to happen anyway.
Right.
So this has been fabulous, Paul. My last question for you. First of all, I'm so excited for Moonbeam. So thank you for tackling what is, I'd say, you know, a really big need out there in the marketplace. Where can people go to connect with you and to learn more or get on that wait list for Moonbeam?
Yeah, so if they want to try the podcast player, it's just moonbeam.fm. If they want to read articles that I've written about startups, and again, I've started 6 or 7 companies, they can just go to my blog, which is just paulenglish.com.
So I don't know if you have an answer for this or not on the back end side, but of all the blogs that you've written, which one has resonated the most and why do you think that's the case?
Oh God, that's funny. I used to look at Google Analytics for this. I haven't done that in a long time. I'm just looking at my blog right now. If you click on it, there's a link called articles, which is a link of a bunch of articles, just like a couple dozen articles there. Surprisingly, one of my most popular articles is a chocolate cake recipe that it used to be when you went to Google and type chocolate cake, my recipe showed up on the first page.
Oh, how funny.
But I think time management is, I have a thing on time management that I've gotten a lot of really good feedback on email handling. How is it that I get 300 or 400 emails a day, but there's only ever 10 in my inbox?
Oh.
So my specific technique for that. And
can you share a little bit about that right now? Because I got 75 emails between like 4 a.m. and 7 a.m. this morning. I was like,
Yeah, the main thing is you want to do one of four things with every email that comes in. They all begin with the letter D. I'm really into alliteration. So number one is when you get an email and it's not something doesn't have to take action, you just delete it. And my message to people is you probably can delete more emails than you think. A lot of times they just stay in your inbox.
Yeah.
And then a month later you end up deleting it. But if you really don't need to take action on this, just delete it. The second thing is if someone emails you and asks for who is that electrician you used at your house? Because I need an electrician. You could save that email and get to it when you have time, but it's only going to take you 30 seconds to find an electrician phone number. Just do it right then. So that's do something about it immediately. And then it's out of your inbox.
Yeah.
The third one is delegation, which is really important. If there's an email and there's someone who's better than you at answering it, forward it to them. The trick here is to trust the people you delegate to. Just forward them the email, maybe with some editorial, and trust that they'll get done. Yeah. If they don't get it done, the original person will ask you again, and then you can follow up. I can't believe a lot of people who use these third-party tools to track all the delegations and so they can keep track of it and follow it up. It's too much. It's too much. And then number four is defer. And this means if it's something you can't do immediately or delegate or delete, it's going to sit in your inbox. I use Gmail, which I think is the best emailer. I would star it, say this is something to pay attention to, but I try to only have at most 10 things started in my inbox a day. And if I feel like it's crawling up, these are emails that require like a good 5 to 10 minutes or more to process. I then just block time on my calendar and I go through all of them. And I can tell you, like, again, I get hundreds of emails a day. My inbox right now, you and I have been talking for an hour. I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I have 7 emails in my inbox right now.
That's amazing. I'm going to throw in from the other perspective for a second and say that I work really hard to only send emails that someone needs to read because I'm so aware. Yeah. I'm so hyper aware. And I try to aggregate. Here's the other thing I've learned over time is I try to aggregate my content. So like, for example, when we sent your person all our stuff, there isn't one email with the questions, one email with the link, one email with like important things to know. It all comes in one email. So that it's one email and everything is in one place. And
I think
people need to be a little bit more respectful of people's inboxes.
That's great.
One of my pet peeves. But I love what you were just saying. And I think all too often we get bogged down with all the little ones, like find the electrician or like, do you know if so-and-so did this, blah, blah. Here's the other thing I'd say when it comes to being innovative and prioritizing getting stuff done. If you are carrying around a lot of junk that isn't done, it becomes open loops in your head. And then you create this mental residue that's all this like, it's like weights in your brain and it gets hard to do anything else that really matters because all that stuff is floating around and it's part of how our brain works. It's hard for us to control that. So you're better off, you're better off getting it done. It's funny because you know how everyone says do your most important thing in the morning always? I like that, but I always spend 10 minutes first getting rid of those little things so that I don't think about them, so that they're gone out of my head, off my desk. And like, it just takes me 5 minutes and then I have open space to actually think. So I thank you for sharing that. I would absolutely go to Paul's blog because I feel like there's obviously a lot more goodness there. But I'm feeling really bad about my inbox, which I feel like has become a filing cabinet. I'm gonna have to deal with that. All right, Paul, what's your final piece of advice for all of us everyday innovators out there? You've given us so much goodness, but what's the final piece of advice?
Well, it's one that's not unique to me. It's advice that I've read, but it's been the most meaningful feedback that I've gotten. We all have heard that you are the average of the 5 people you spend time with. So I just want people to be intentional about who do you spend time with. Sometimes we get in a rut that we go drink beers with the same person every Thursday. And the question is, are you spending time with people that lift you up and push you to be better and are role models to you? Like if you look back on your calendar for the last month and you would put a plus or minus in every meeting last month, which ones lifted you? Which meetings made you better? Because hopefully all of us have sort of a personal mission statement of what we want to achieve in life and how we want to be known at the end of our life and after our life. And if you are serious about self-improvement and achieving things, surround yourself with people that are, number one, like really fun and ethical people and humble, but number two, who can help advance you along the paths that where you want to learn.
So I love that advice. To your point, I think it's more important than we really think. I got a question for you on it though. How have you found is the best way to get rid of, move aside, move on from those that maybe they're good people, but they're not serving you in that way?
I think it's, you could either, there's one of two ways to do this. You could either be really direct and just say, like if it's a drinking buddy, you can just say, I'm going to cut back on my drinking for a while. So I'm going to check out, just focus more of my time on X, whatever X is for you. So you give them explicit feedback, or like what a lot of people do these days, I guess I don't really advise this, but like I know in the dating world, a lot of people just ghost each other. When someone emails you, maybe you don't not reply, but you reply and say, I'm not available this week. Let me get back out to you when things thin out for me.
I'm only laughing because I was in that world for quite a bit in the last couple of years. And the ghosting drives me. I would never ghost anyone. I just couldn't do it. Like it just drove me so nuts.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
I can't wrap my head around how people could be, just say no. Yeah. No, thank you. That's that simple. All right. That's a whole different podcast, but Paul, this has been fantastic. You shared so much. There's so much wisdom in here, not just about, I'd say like the nuts and bolts of a company, but how you deal with it and how you think about it. So thank you for sharing with us. For those of you who listened and are watching, I hope you were taking notes. And if you were in your car, I hope you go back later and take notes and go to Moonbeam. I know I'm going to find myself on there too. So Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Tamara. It's great to talk to you.